Today's episode has been brought to you by Roberta's, located at 261 Moore Street in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. For more information, visit www.robertaspizza.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that sin. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. Every year, about 20 days before Christmas, we get to celebrate another very special holiday. Today is the 79th anniversary of the repeal on Prohibition. And in the studio today, I have one of the newest members on my team over at Prime Meats, a hardcore tiki cocktail aficionado, and all-around great bartender, Garrett Richard. Welcome to the show.
Happy Repeal Day, Dan.
Happy Repeal Day. Glad to have you here, man. So, I guess we're talking about Prohibition today. I can't think of anything else we can talk about.
No, I think we are required by law.
Yeah, exactly. So, just getting into it. First of all, there was, to me, Prohibition was like into like all of us who work in the industry or even just enjoy having a cocktail. It's one of the strangest, weirdest, like political like flubs in history to ever happen. I mean, it created a lot of. A lot of like crime and things that the government thought it was going to cut down on, you know, like a bunch of rambunctious behavior, ended up actually making things a lot worse over 13 years.
Yeah. Well, you know, historically before that, every law was an expansion of freedom. Mm-hmm. This was one that was not. And usually most laws were based on some sort of biblical or historical morality, and this was unprecedented. It was going against thousands of years of human history and development, and, you know, we had been drinking spirits for centuries and then, you know, wine and beer before that. And suddenly it seems like out of nowhere it just happened. But it was an effort since the beginning of America to try and take that freedom away, you know, starting with the Quakers and then with women's Christians group coming up and really trying to give a dysfunctional answer to a dysfunctional society.
It was a very dysfunctional answer. I mean, for sure, because, I mean, granted, people were imbibing quite a bit more back then. I mean, you could say that. I mean, I know a lot of my friends are probably right on par with the people back then about a century ago as far as what they take in. But, yeah, I mean, like, rather than figuring out a way to control that, you know, in a proper way, just getting rid of it altogether seemed like a very, very harsh solution for, you know, family problems, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it was touted as a solution to almost every interest group, and the Anti-Saloon League really was the best lobbying effort that this nation has ever seen. It really makes, you know, as Ken Burns said when he was promoting his documentary, it makes the NRA look like child's play. I mean, to racists, you could say that it, you know, prevented blacks from getting the bottle and getting uppity. To blacks, it was in the NAACP. It prevented, you know, people from being oppressed by the bottle. To anyone who feared German influence, you know, it prevented those German brewers from having power. I mean, any problem that you had with American society, the Anti-Saloon League had an answer, and it had to do with getting rid of alcohol, which, I mean, today you don't really see a single issue that strong anymore. You know, there's right to life issues, but really this one answered everything, and it seemed like the solution, but... Yeah. As you know, as we saw, it was created a lot of unintended consequences.
Sure, I mean, just to start out with, I mean, the illegal importing of booze and moonshining and, you know, speakeasies. I mean, we'll start out talking about, you know, the importation of these different alcohols from, you know, through Canada, through Chicago. You know, everyone talks about Al Capone bringing booze in. I mean, it was coming from every direction, though, really.
California popularized tequila for an audience that really didn't want to have anything to do with the stuff beforehand. And, you know, after Prohibition, Bing Crosby actually imported Herradura to you know, a new audience that, you know, got support for it during Prohibition because it was available and it was just a quick car ride away.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you kind of think about that is like, where would we be as like a modern society with the margarita being one of the most popular cocktails? It's one of the like three drinks that even if you don't drink or never had any interest in it, a 6-year-old kid could tell
you're aware
of a margarita, you know, which is pretty funny. I mean, like, and then like Pisco, you know, was also being imported through like Northern California and like
San Francisco.
Yeah, absolutely. So like there are all these in a way, it's kind of cool that we were starting to get a lot of different types of alcohol because we were restricting ourselves. You know, we were definitely a nation that was like built on whiskey. We think about whiskey being our main thing. Whiskeys and rums, I guess you could say. But, you know, with bourbon and rye being so popular, and not just regular drinking, but like in cocktails especially, you know, to take that away all of a sudden, you did actually open up the opportunity for these other spirits to come in and mix, you know, mix some cool drinks with them. But yeah, it's...
Yeah, I think it's easy to say that Prohibition happened, the cocktail died, and, you know, dark period. But really, I think you can see from distances now a benefit of Prohibition, which is it did open up people more to rum. It opened up people to tequila and pisco, as we're saying. And then, as we talked about earlier, New York speakeasies really were able to reform the bar format and do new things because it wasn't a business. It was more of an underground social thing. And
it's the original rave.
Yeah, it was the original rave, really.
I hope I never have those words come out of my lips again. But yeah, I mean, essentially that's what it was.
Yeah, you had some bars, the Country Club, which was the original, it was the spiritual ancestor to the BCC. It had on 48th, and it had a capacity of 400. It had a mini golf course. It had ping pong tables. I mean, a ping pong table in a saloon before that, I think you would be thrown out if you wanted to play ping pong. They would say, you know, go in the field and do that. And then you had some other places. Duke's. Duke was a mani pedicurist who decided to open up a speakeasy and would offer that service to people while you were getting hammered. I mean, it was the original beauty bar.
That's a good way of putting it, man. You've got all the answers to all the modern
they're all just bars. Ripping off you know, speakeasies of the
I would
earlier
say influenced
era.
By
yeah. Not ripping up. But yeah, I mean, what's interesting when you look at these old places is there really were different levels of speakeasy. There were the personality-driven places like Duke's, and there was another places called the El Rey that had Python dancers and whatnot. So you had those speakeasies. And then you also had ones that were gangster-run, which is the popular mythos, and that definitely was there. But then you also had something called the Shock House, which were very popular in the Bowery area. And that was the rot-gut drug den version of the speakeasy. And actually in 1928 alone, you had 700 deaths from, you know, rot gut poisonous booze.
Right. Bathtub gins and just strange concoctions people are making in their shacks out in the woods and then bringing them into the city. And, you know, like we were saying before the show too, you were saying New York City was actually like the epicenter of debauchery, you know, during Prohibition, it was called Satan's Seat.
Yeah, Chicago really takes the image because of Al Capone, but we had conservative estimate said 30,000 speakeasies, but it was probably more around 100,000, which is, I mean, 30,000 was double the amount of bars before Prohibition. So if it was anywhere near the liberal estimates, I mean, that's incredible.
Sure. And nowadays we say that there's around 18,000 bars in New York City. So anywhere between 18 and 20, depending on what your definition of a bar is. So to have 100,000 of them, you know, upwards of 100,000.
That boggles the mind.
That's crazy. That means, like, for as secretive as you were trying to be with a speakeasy, you could basically knock on almost every other door, every third door, and that would be a speakeasy.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of openly, you know, open lawbreakers in New York. There was a chain of cordial stores, which, you know, had a very small facade of just like Coca-Cola and ginger ale in the window displays, but when you went in, booze was being sold out in the open. And actually, those cordial stores, I forget the name of the family that owned them, but they were one of the biggest financial supporters of the New York PD for good reason.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I mean, you know, the popular quote from that era from the Wets was that Fiorello LaGuardia actually said that, you know, if you were to do prohibition in New York, you would need 250,000 cops and then 250,000 police to police the police. Yeah. You know?
And that's true. And I think, you know, going back to what we were saying before, how it created a lot more crime. Of course, you know, you've got people like police officers, government officials being paid off so we can bring this stuff in. And it's kind of like, you know, just to appease like the popular thought process back in the day, you know, and the outlook on imbibing, a lot of politicians probably were like, you know what, I don't really believe in this, but this is going to get me more votes, and I'll find a way to get my drink on.
Oh, definitely, yeah, and there were a lot of people within the Anti-Saloon League that, you know, were the biggest hypocrites themselves. I mean, it's politicians haven't changed from then to now. I mean, it's pretty easy to see, you know, the parallels.
Yeah. So there was also, so prohibition lasted 13 years. Okay. It went into effect 1920. Then, you know, 79 years ago today, 1933, it was they finally gave that law the boot. But that wasn't really the end of prohibition for a lot of
places.
No,
I mean, first of all, before 1933, Colorado was the first state to, on a statewide level, to bring back alcohol. And it's interesting in the last election that they brought back marijuana. I mean, it's interesting how history repeats itself. But what you saw after the repeal of prohibition was there were still dry states. I mean, your home state, Oklahoma, 1959, finally repealed prohibition, 66 with Mississippi. And when you keep that in mind, you can really sort of understand, I think, the political landscape a little bit more. I mean, an oppressive law like that still existed in those states. You
know, absolutely. In the Bible
Belt.
Most
of the 20th century. Yeah.
The Bible Belt was a lot wider back then. So yeah. It took a lot more time to cinch it. But yeah, I mean, like, even for, like, I mean, a lot of times when you think about Colorado, you're not thinking about spirits. You're thinking a lot about beer. I mean, you've got, like, you know, Coors in Golden, Golden Colorado. That's a huge, huge company. Yeah. So it's like, dude, I mean, I'm sure they were chomping at the bit to get back out there and make some money again, you know?
Yeah, well, that was the other thing. I mean, you're in the middle of a Great Depression. You have much larger problems at hand, and a lot of people just looked around and said, you know, I think that there's bigger issues and we're losing a lot of revenue. But going towards prohibition before it happened, the 16th Amendment, the actual income tax, really helped the dry argument out, because the biggest contention against them was, where is the revenue stream going to come from that we're losing? Our fifth largest industry is liquor.
And it was the first tax to go into effect.
Yeah, and the income tax was their answer. So whenever you're doing your taxes on tax day, that's another sting of prohibition you can remember. Yeah. That was a dry plot.
Absolutely, man. I was thinking about that just the other day.
Yeah.
You always have to have a drink in hand when you open up your paycheck.
Oh, bars do very well on tax day. Oh, that's for sure.
Absolutely. You know, just going back to that as well, like before prohibition, let's talk about that for a little bit, because to me there was a huge change in, like we were talking about before, about like the way that bars kind of were opened up to have their unique kind of style and theme, like the putt-putt golf, the country club, and the Cobra Dancers. Before prohibition, it was, I mean, obviously it was ramping up and it was getting a lot more fun.
Yeah, I think there was a format, though, definitely.
Yeah, there was definitely.
And there was definitely, you know, no women allowed. I mean, unless you were a lady of the night, you probably were not in bars.
Yeah, yeah, so you look at like 13, 15 years later and how much shutting down all the bars has changed bars in general. And I mean, to some extent, that's cool. I've been to a lot of really stupidly themed bars these days, but at the same time, it's like,
you know,
it was cool that it opened
when
it
up. When it's an innovation, it's, well, not always, but it's usually done with care, you know. And, you know, some of these places, they had, you know, neon fountains and beautiful artwork that was never done before. So I think that having a sea change in at least design and feel was right. Obviously, in drinks, no. But we're learning that now. We're learning to do both, which is good.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, let's talk about the modern speakeasy, as it were, and some of the styles and some of the big differences from back then to now. We'll be right back with Garrett Richards on Speakeasy.
You're listening to Sweet Talk by Pamela Royal on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
I love that commercial.
Best sweeper ever.
Awesome. You're listening to The Speakeasy. I've got Garrett Richard from my bar, Primeats.
Yeah, Primeats.
Well, not my bar, but the one I work at. But we've been talking about Prohibition, as it turns out to be Prohibition Day, or Repeal Day.
Repeal Day.
79
happy
years.
Happy freedom.
Yeah, happy freedom, absolutely. So right before the break, we were talking about, we started talking about like the differences between the speakeasies of the past to the quote-unquote speakeasies of today.
Yeah, the faux speakeasies. I mean, they brought cocktails back in the popular imagination. I mean, to I think a major extent, you know, bars like Milk and Honey, Employees Only. I mean, they really were the progenitors of the modern cocktail movement. And you know, it's funny. You know, a lot of people today, especially in newer cities that are adopting sort of this format of bar, believe it's a generator of buzz. But you know, it's interesting when you hear Sasha's story that a lot of the speakeasy stuff, you know, he is a huge fan of the 1920s, but a lot of it was just out of respect for a fellow friend who he was renting space from. I mean, that's why he soundproofed it. That's why he had a secret entrance. You know, it's funny how, you know, these things can become a myth of their own, even, you know, after years of being open.
Well, you know, the funny thing about it, too, is like we talk about like speakeasy cocktails and stuff like that. I mean, and the idea, like the classicism of it, which I think, to me, actually, probably stemmed from the whole swing movement of the 1990s, you know, and it was like martini.
Big bad time. Voodoo daddy. Yeah, you know, I have a dirty secret. I worked for one of my first jobs was working for a station that played a lot of that music. It was called Fabulous 690, the Lounge in Los Angeles.
Nice. Yeah, but like you know, you see where I'm coming from here. Like that was like really the first movement to go back into like classic. Like martini, like actual martinis, rather than like the anything in a V-shaped glass being a martini.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was so out of style. It was in, you know. I mean, after parrot heads and disco shots, sure. And you know, white Russians, something that's clear in a sexy glass. I mean, really does make a statement.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there is an overwhelming like kind of classicism to that. You know, it's fun to like go back in time a little bit, you know, but if we were really legitimately going back in time to a speakeasy, I mean, the drinks were terrible. You were getting a lot of rock cut, like we were saying before. We were importing just whatever we could get. You were paying a big price for a cheap shot, you know?
Yeah, it was overpriced in a lot of cities. I think in New York, what happened is you had a price spike, and then, you know, as we said earlier, you had so many bars that it fairly regulated itself, but it's definitely wasn't prices pre-prohibition, yeah. That's for sure.
So what's cool about the quote-unquote speakeasy bar nowadays is, like, you go there for, like, of course, a kind of a classic experience, but also the drinks are great. You know,
yeah, and it's a form of escapism, too.
Yeah.
It throws back to that era. But, I mean, like, the original speakeasies sort of had exclusivity in mind more on the terms of protection, not on having the right people and, you know, having a sort of nice ambiance. The owners of the 21 Club, who were two cousins, they actually were not mob affiliated, and they had two bars before 21. They had the Redhead and the Iron Gate, and they slowly learned their lessons over time that you have to let the right people in, or otherwise you're going to get roughed up by gangs or, you know, broken up by a rogue agent. Luckily, those two brothers had a lot of cousins had a lot of friends in the federal government and on the New York police force. But I mean, that's probably why that bar has survived today, and it's a nice relic to have, and it's beautiful space.
Yeah, and you know, another thing, going back to the like the new cocktail recipes, and I mean, even with the classics, for so long we couldn't get like good vermouth, and it was really hard to find rye, you know. So
yeah.
Now you can actually make really amazing Manhattan cocktails, you know, in old fashions and all these things. But something that we're seeing a lot more these days, I mean, and, you know, over the past, you know, 7-8 years, there's a lot more of a culinary aspect going into cocktails and, like, quote unquote, like modern classics, you know. So where do you think that stemmed from?
I think that a lot of it had to do with, during Prohibition, you didn't have access to alcohol if you wanted to do a legal mixology sort of project. And I think soda fountains really took that in a really unique and nice direction. I mean, before Prohibition, there were soda fountains competing with bars. That is true. And it's often a myth that they appeared after. But what a lot of people don't say is that they were competing with drugs, usually in the drink, something, you know, like cocaine or narcotic. And then the Pure Food and Drug Act passed in 1906, I believe it's 06. And you had these pharmacies that, you know, had to stick to the rules. But when they did, they actually made some, you know, pretty amazing concoctions. And thanks to Darcy O'Neill, we actually got to see some of them in his book, Fix the Pumps. I mean, one of them is I think it's called a Heap of Comfort, and it has I mean, this sounds like it's straight out of Booker and Dax. It has malted milk, clam bouillon, you know, lots of I think like a acid phosphate, and you know, like cardamom tincture or something. I mean, they were definitely working with a lot of tools that other, you know, bartenders before weren't working with, and the extension of that is definitely the tiki cocktail. I think that the soda fountain is sort of the in-between of the classic mixology era and then tiki drinks, because tiki drinks essentially are, you know, besides being rum forward, they focus a lot on interesting syrups and sugars and spices. And that's basically what soda fountain drinks were really interesting syrups that were complex. Like a simple cherry syrup was not cherries and sugar and water. It usually involved cherry bark extract.
Sometimes almond.
Yeah, extract. Almond. They were definitely very complex. And what Trader Vic did is have his complex syrups, and Don had his complex syrups, and made incredible drinks with them.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's funny because, like, the tiki, and we have talked quite a bit, you know, tiki Adam Kulisar comes on the show quite a bit, and, you know, he's one of the foremost experts on the history.
He's the best, subject. Man.
And it's cool that, you know, like what we were talking about even before the break about like the before and after of Prohibition. You know, before we were, even with cocktails, it was a lot of, you know, stirred, boozy, bitter. And then by the time you reached the end of Prohibition, this is when, like, you know, 34-ish, you know, we've got like all these tiki bars starting to pop up. And so from the beginning to the end of Prohibition, I guess this would go back to what you were saying about having your different like themes of bars. You know, like you can actually have a tropical bar, and you can have.
I mean, these were designed to shock and awe new audiences that maybe wouldn't go into a bar that often, or just wanted something new and exciting. Because inherently, if it's illegal, it's new and exciting.
Sure, I only try to do illegal things.
Yeah, me too.
But yeah, I mean, like, I think it's pretty cool. You know, there were a lot of speakeasies that were probably already experimenting with rums because it was another thing that they could get that was coming in from out of the country as well.
Yeah, and then, you know, you have people traveling specifically
to get away from prohibition.
And and, you know, that's when you get drinks like the 10-mile limit, the 12-mile limit, and, you know, then obviously the drinks that are abroad, all the bartenders that were saying, I'm not going to be a criminal, I'm going to go to a country where I'm appreciated, and, you know, the New York, Harry's New York bar and all those, which I think, you know, the misconception is those popped up after we made it illegal. But the American bar was something that was a phenomenon before that. But really, they finally got the talent, the American talent, to do things, you know, like the Bloody Mary and the Sidecar and really these, you know, incredible drinks that still are in the lexicon today, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I love a Bloody Mary in the morning. Thing is, like, I know, like, a lot of bartenders, it's a point of contention for them to, like, make a Bloody Mary at night. But you got to think about it, man.
It's really easy to make. I mean, if you have your spices together.
Yeah,
you know.
But it's also one of those things, like, there's this weird stigma, like you can't have one after, like, 4 o'clock in the afternoon or something like that. But it was a really, it was always a very popular drink to have any time.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's funny. I'll do... you know, I work Sunday brunches with, you know, at Primates, and then I work Sunday nights as well. And then a lot of the times I've made probably, you know, 100 Bloody Marys, but I come home at 9 o'clock and my girlfriend May wants a Bloody Mary. I have no problem with that.
Yeah.
And I have one too, even though I've made a million of them. I don't think it's an issue as long as your head is in the right space, you know?
Yeah. I think it's also an issue of usually like, at that time of night, they probably don't have anything prepared, you know, and it's
funny to see it, and I've been in this position too, to see a bartender scramble for a can of V8.
Right, exactly. But yeah, I mean, like, if you think about back in those days, there were so many, like a bull shot, you know, that would be a great thing to have at night, you know, with some beef bouillon and you know, like, these savory drinks.
Have you done that? You know, I've only been at Primates so long. Have you guys ever done that? Considering, you know, the amount of red meat that goes through there?
We've played around with it.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's ever...
I figured you've, you know, to some extent.
It might not make it onto the menu anytime soon, but I think we could perfect it and make it unique in a very cool way. But yeah, I mean, like, going back to the tiki thing again... I think it was also, like, you know, we're going into World War II, and, you know, people are traveling even more, so we're getting all these Polynesian ingredients, but there then comes the 50s, and it was almost like another thing that happened with, like, a kind of a secret prohibition, you know, because, like, all these
the
martini
that's,
boom. And
that's
like,
interesting you mentioned
with vodka
that.
And,
I feel it's almost a cultural reaction in a sense that the Prohibition era was extremely chaotic at home, and then the war era was extremely chaotic abroad. And then you just wanted, you know, I think the American collective as a reaction just wanted some peace and stability. And what ended up happening was like Eisenhower hour conformity, you know. And it just, it's very weird to think that those eras preceded it, you know, and to have the one glass, you know, simple bar, you know, after that, you know, but it makes sense if you wanted your perfect society. I mean, it's almost as if the dries just had a sort of cultural win during that period more than anything.
Yeah. Yes. Our drinking history, our cultural and imbibing history in the United States is very interesting, man. And I think that's like why both you and I got into it, you know, in the
first
place.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's funny too, when you look back, I'm sure you have lessons you had as a, you know, kid in high school or even younger, about history, and then you look back and go, oh man, they were drinking a lot during that period of time. You know, Johnny Appleseed was not planting apple trees because he likes apples. He likes apple brandy, yeah. And he likes apple cider. And, you know, it's funny. You just look back and you're like, oh, if I only had that information in fourth grade, I could really cause some chaos.
Exactly, yeah. Well, that's about it for the show today. Garrett, thank you so much for coming on. Happy Repeal Day. And please come back on sometime soon, anytime you'd like.
I love it. Thanks,
Simon. I just want to say again, Happy Repeal Day. And thank you so much to Heritage Radio Network for having me on. This is my 2-year anniversary today as well. And I just want to say thanks to Jack and Aaron and Patrick and Joe and everyone here. And thank you to all the guests that have come on over the last 2 years. All right, guys. That's it for the speakeasy today. Be safe. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.